today, and we're using the BlueJeans system. It worked fine on the last one. This is also streamed, so the public can watch it. Unfortunately, turns out there was a problem on the audio on the streaming, but it's apparently been fixed. We'll hear about it if that occurs, but the main thing is we could hear from council, and everything went well, and we hope to repeat it. This next case is number 77858-COA, Charles Landon versus Maria Jaramillo Landon. This is the time set for the argument. We have Ms. DeFilippo representing the appellant, Mr. Landon, and Ms. McFarland representing the respondent, Ms. Jaramillo. Ms. DeFilippo, do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 3 minutes.
Okay, 3 minutes, and you should be able to see the clock on the screen. We appreciate you taking this case on also through the pro bono program. And Ms. McFarland, it's nice to see you back. You're a regular here, and you're going to be here again this afternoon, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right, Ms. DeFilippo, you may proceed then.
Thank you, I'm sorry.
I forgot to introduce everybody. Michael Gibbons in Carson City, Judge Jerry Tao in Las Vegas, Judge Bonnie Bulla in Las Vegas. Judge Tao or Judge Bulla, would you like to make any welcoming comments?
So just to thank you guys for accommodating us and doing the argument this way through the through the video and audio system. I know it's not what everybody would choose, but it's the best we can come up with, and really appreciate your working with our staff and our IT guys to get everybody online, and we're looking forward to the argument.
I would just join what Judge Tao says, and if there's a point where you can't understand a question, please let us know, and we'll be happy to rephrase it. Okay. So thank you so much.
And we are still following the COVID-19 protocols, so in the courthouse, everybody's wearing a mask. The one exception I make is when I'm in the courtroom in Carson City, because I'm the only one at this very large bench. Judge Tao and Judge Bull are obviously close to each other in the Las Vegas courtroom, so they're going to continue on with the mask. And I'm glad counsel don't have to wear a mask. All right, Ms. DeFilippo, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tracy DeFilippo, and I represent Charles Landon, and I'm happy to represent him in this pro bono matter. I would like to first point out that the lower court found, and Maria Landon does not dispute, that she failed to properly renew the judgment because she failed to send Charles Landon a copy of the affidavit of renewal through certified mail within 3 days after filing pursuant to NRS 17214 subsection 3. The issue, as the court is well aware by reading the brief, is that there was a judgment, a divorce decree entered on April 26, 2012, and whether that started the accrual date for the renewal time frame, or whether their settlement discussions in 2016 restarted, hold, or changed that accrual date. The parties agree that if judgment is not satisfied, it may be renewed for additional 6 years pursuant to 17214. Also, the parties agree that divorce decrees are subject to the statute. And finally, the parties also agree an action upon a judgment and a renewal of a judgment are two separate acts. The lower court relied on the Nevada Supreme Court case of Davison versus Davison, but that case doesn't exactly apply here for the following reason. First, it involved an action upon a judgment. This case involves a renewal of a judgment. Why is that different, the court may wonder? Well, an action upon a judgment can have a different accrual date than a judgment for renewal. With respect to renewal, you look at the date that the judgment is entered, and then you have 6 years, how long that judgment is good for, then you have to renew it. The renewal is just a ministerial act, which the Nevada Supreme Court has said in prior case law. There is nothing for the creditor to prove to show good cause to get that renewal. All they have to do is complete the affidavit of renewal, and then the clerk files that. Versus an action upon a judgment, there may be certain things that the creditor has to prove to show that there's timeliness, that there's other issues to go forward, and there may be defenses to that. Also, an action upon a renewal can be told. For instance, maybe there's certain prerequisites that the creditor has to do before they can file their action upon a judgment. Maybe the debtor files a bankruptcy case and the case is stayed, so it prevents them from going forward on the action upon a judgment. But they're filing a renewal because it's just a ministerial act. Nothing changes.
So let me ask you this. Why does it matter? Because in Charles's response below, he says that the judgment has been superseded anyway because of this 2016 settlement agreement. Why doesn't that restart the limitations period?
Well, then, Your Honor, I mean, I don't think if that's the case, if that's the theory that we're looking at, then a creditor can just decide, well, I'm going to probably miss the deadline to renew, so I'm going to give a credit to the debtor so I can restart the time frame. If the settlement discussions, if that supersedes it, then the original debt under the judgment is no longer evidence of the indebtedness. It's a different agreement, and that's subject to it. But there's no meeting of the minds in this case with respect to that oral agreement, settlement discussions, whatever you want to call it, because, for one, Maria Landon disputed that below as to whether it was agreement. She changes her position on the appeal, but if she felt that there was an agreement, why did she file the renewal of the judgment? That would be a separate agreement upon which she would, if there was a breach, she would file an action upon that agreement.
So here's the factual question. Let's drill down to the heart of this. What's the obligation to pay here? Is the obligation created by the 2012 decree, or is it the 2016 settlement contract? Who pays what and why? Is it what happened in 2012, or is it what happened in 2016?
The evidence of the indebtedness, the original debt, is the obligation triggered once the judgment, the decree, was entered on April 26th of 2012. That's when the evidence of debt. There was no.
So what was the subject matter of the 2016 contract that Charles, by the way, says exists?
Charles said that it exists as to that they agreed to a resolution of that he would pay back charges on the mobile home and then give the mobile home to Maria Landon so she could sell it along with a piece of land, and whatever she got, then that would resolve whatever he owed her, whatever that amount was, whether she got $10,000 or whether she got $50,000. But Maria says no, it was only below, she disagreed with that. She said she paid for the mobile home, and it was worth $15,000, and she paid $10,000. But now she says on appeal that if she had sold it, then she would only the judgment would only be forgiven if she got enough. So there was no meeting of the minds. They're changing their position as to what the agreement was or was not. It was not in writing, Your Honor.
Does that matter?
Counsel, I guess that's my question. I just want to confirm. The 2016 agreement was never in writing. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. It was not in writing. Maria Landon argues that it is subject to it's the sale of goods and subject to the statute of NRS 104-220, subsection 1. But under that section, it requires it to be in writing, and it was not in writing. It's not a sale of goods. It's a mobile home and a piece of land. In addition, it would be subject to the statute of frauds, and there's an exception to the statute of frauds, which is full performance, and Maria Landon argues that there was only partial performance.
Well, I mean, there's another exception to the statute of frauds, which is if you admit that it exists in litigation, which your client did in his motion, isn't that an exception to the statute of frauds?
There still has to be an admission as to all of the essential terms. One of the essential terms of a settlement agreement is the release provision. He says that it would be whatever money she got for the mobile home and the land would release him from the judgment. Maria Landon disputes that. So that is a very important essential term that prior case law in Nevada says that is an essential term, and if the release provisions are not set forth and agreed to by the parties, then the settlement agreement was not actually formed.
So, Ms. DeFilippo, what do we do with this problem? Because below, your client said there was a settlement agreement. The judge relied upon that, entered the minute order, and then a written order was submitted that was consistent with the minute order. Before the written order was filed, Ms. Jaramillo filed her opposition, but it does not appear that the district court considered the opposition. So all we have is the district court's ruling based upon the motion filed by Mr. Landon. Now, on appeal, you've taken the opposite position of what Mr. Landon asserted below and said there was no agreement, and the respondent has taken the opposite position also, saying that there was an agreement. So we have a pleading that's essentially a fugitive document in the record because it was filed too late, and it does not look like it was even considered by the district court. So all we have is his pleading. His pleading says there was an agreement. The judge relied upon that representation and therefore made his ruling. Are we now supposed to look at other facts and get to the underlying nature of this contract and whether it's enforceable or whether there are defenses to it when that's not what was presented to the district court for it to make its decision?
Your Honor, that is a very good question, and I appreciate the question. If the court is, if the court wants to say that they're relying on what the district court looked at and said that Mr. Landon said that there was a settlement agreement, then that's a novation, and it supersedes the original agreement. So there is no judgment. Then that is the agreement that Maria Landon needs to enforce. There. You can't have it both ways. You can't have the original agreement and then also have another agreement. That doesn't restart the statute of limitations as to the renewal. The NRS 11200 talks about when the time frame accrues, and that is supported by Davison versus Davison as to the evidence of indebtedness, and that is the start date. It doesn't restart it. It doesn't toll it. If there was a settlement agreement, and if it's based on what the court is saying that that was sufficient, even though there was no meeting of the minds as to the release terms, then there you can't have the judgment. That is supersedes it, and that's what they need to go forward with. At a bare minimum, this court should at least reverse and remand and send it back down to the court to have an evidentiary hearing of whether there was a settlement agreement, because the release terms were not agreed to. As I said, Mr. Landon thinks that based on their agreement, whatever she got on a mobile home, whatever that is, then he would be released from that judgment. She says he would only be released from that judgment if she got at least the amount that was the judgment. Those are disputed facts, and that's something that the lower court should have determined, but did not do that. They are claiming now that there was a valid contract that was not before the court below, and that shouldn't be before this court right now, but that's what they're arguing right now. So at least the court should send it back down so Mr. Landon can prove whether she's actually sold the mobile home and how much has been sold.
Well, that would certainly help clean up this mess here because of the records confusing, but is that what we really need to do when the only issue is the district court actually granted Mr. Landon's request and said that the judgment was not renewed and that was in error when the court entered that order, but then the court went on to say that Mr. Landon's request to say the judgment is expired is denied. And then the judge takes it one step further and says enforcement is a different issue. It's a complex issue. Counsel should be consulted and we'll deal with that on another day. So do we have a narrow issue here or we just rule on whether this judgment, in fact, the judge is right because he said it was expired, but the issue about the enforceability a later date can be saved for a later date.
Your Honor, I appreciate that. If the court did not make the determination of whether the settlement agreements or whether any oral contract was valid, but did say that it restarted the statute of limitations, and I don't think that's the proposition that the Nevada Supreme Court put forth in Davison versus Davison.
Right, so that's the last transaction. We have to decide whether that agreement is a last transaction. And if we just take his pleading and nothing else, it looks like a last transaction.
Well, then that Your Honor, in Davison versus Davison, the Supreme Court rejected that you can move the date of the original indebtedness. They argued that, you know, staying in the home or, you know, Your Honors, staying in the home or, you know, refinancing the home changed the date of the evidence of indebtedness. You look at the when that is, and that is when the court entered this divorce decree. So I would recommend that you reverse and remand this case and say that that was not the last transaction. It did not change the date, and the judgment is expired. If there's a new agreement, let the court determine that. Thank you, Your Honor.
So I know I'm getting into rebuttal time. Maybe we can add a minute, but let me just here's the issue that hopefully you can tell that we're all struggling with a little bit, which is below your client, Charles, said there was a contract, and now you're asking for us to remand this case for an evidentiary hearing to determine whether Charles told the truth or not. I mean, that's a little bit of an odd position to take, don't you think?
No, Your Honors, we're asking to remand to decide whether with respect to the release provisions, there is a dispute. If there was a settlement agreement, then, and he says that whatever money she got, then that released him, and she is disputing that. That is in dispute, and those are essential terms to any settlement agreement.
All right, thank you. Thank you. We'll still have your full 2 minutes for a rebuttal. And Ms. McFarland, you can go ahead. Keep in mind these questions that have been posed, and Ms. DeFilippo also apply to your client, just from a little different perspective, but they're all in play on both sides.
Good morning, Your Honors. Emily McFarling, appearing for the respondent, Maria Landon. Some of the issues that come up in this case are very specific to family court, but yet we're dealing with a very common issue that's addressed outside of family court all the time. And the Davidson case, you know, really gives us a lot of insight into how we need to apply these specific laws when we're dealing with a family court case. In the Davidson case, we have a district court decision that was affirmed on appeal on the issue of when is the time period that the statute of limitations has run. And in the Davidson case, while it was an affirmation of having gone beyond the time period, we actually see the distinctions made in that case are very similar to the distinctions made in this case. So in Davidson, the party sat on her rights for over 6 years, whereas we see in this case, Maria had actually had somewhat constant activity in attempting to collect this debt throughout that time period between 2012 and when this decision was made. We look back at the record and we see that in 2015, she had been attempting to collect from a retirement account and asking for court involvement in that. We have the purported settlement agreement that Charles puts in his motion, but we have a very different situation than the Davidson one, where there literally was no activity at all between the time of a signing of a quitclaim deed and when the issue was brought to court over 6 years later. The big thing to look at in Davidson, though, that is similar to this case. So in this case and in Davidson, we have a decree of divorce that have a court order in it that could start the timing of it. But in Davidson, they did not find that the time period began with the order and the decree of divorce. They found that the time period began when a quitclaim deed was signed. Now, we hear appellant arguing that, oh, you need to have a full agreement, you know, because there's some dispute as to whether or not in this case there was an agreement that happened in 2016, that's not sufficient. But in Davidson, the thing that was sufficient was simply the signing of a quitclaim deed, one action by one side that was the last transaction, right? The wording used for when we look at when the clock began again is transaction. It's not agreement. It's not settlement agreement. It's not, you know, it's something that in different types of cases can be different. In Davidson, when they didn't find that living together or, you know, these other things were transactions, and that's certainly something within the discretion of the district court and was affirmed in that case. Whereas in this case, we have an admission of very specific transaction that occurred in 2016 by Charles. And so the district court found that that was what started the new time period, and that's sufficient for this court to affirm that decision that was made. We have
Ms. McFarlane, let me interrupt you. I'm so sorry, just for a minute, and ask. The negotiations apparently took place in 2016. The initial judgment was filed in 2012, so theoretically you have till 2018 if you apply the statute to renew the judgment. What prevented Maria from just attaching a modified affidavit and renewing the judgment timely, because she had 2 years, right, from 2016 to 2018, to encompass the agreement that they had reached to reduce the amount of money due and owed from Charles? Why didn't she just do that and then timely renew the judgment?
That's a good question. And you know, appellant asked a somewhat similar question in her argument of, you know, if there was an agreement, why did Maria file for a renewal of this? And both of those, even though they're kind of the opposite question, go to the same issue, which is that Maria was in proper person. She's someone who's trying to make sure that she's, you know, dotting her I's and crossing her T's. But we can't expect that the decisions she makes on, is she filing the renewal early in order to be cautious, or is she filing it even though she doesn't need to? Either one of those, I mean, the answer gets to, you know, she's doing the best she can to make sure that she's preserving her rights. But what we do know is that she did properly preserve her rights, and that the district court properly found that, because we do have all of this activity between 2012 and when this order was entered, that any one of them would be sufficient to restart the timing, whether that's the 2015 action that was brought in the same case in the district court, whether that's the purported agreement that Charles lays out in his motion. No matter what, we have a transaction that occurred less than 6 years from when this final order was entered that's on appeal. In appellate's case, in their brief, they cite to a Nalder case for the contention that, you know, the action and the renewal of a judgment are very different things. But what we see in that case is that you must bring either one, either a renewal or an action is sufficient to restart the timing. And in fact, in that case, they say that when you bring an action, it results in a new judgment of the amount still owed, which clearly takes into account that you could have a partial payment or something, but you then, when there's an action, there then is a new judgment in that same amount. And so it doesn't matter. You can't say, well, a renewal or an action are two separate things, and so therefore the clock is different for them. They are two separate mechanisms, but the effect is the same, whether you renew or whether you bring an action to enforce.
Well, Ms. McMurray,
you can't distinguish. Yes.
What she did was not an action. She went through the ministerial act of trying to renew a judgment. She was untimely. She didn't do it the right way. You've already said she was self-represented. The question is your point correct? It doesn't matter, because these other events happened in 2016. So how do we characterize the 2016 events? Wouldn't we have to say they're one of two things? It's either the last transaction, a triggering event to extend the 6 years, or, as the appellant is saying, it's something else. It's a contract that may or may not be enforceable, and then you have to sue under the contract, and then you have the additional problem if it's an oral contract. So what is it? And if it's the first part, if it's the last transaction, how do we apply the Davidson case, which is a little different than this situation, but is it broad enough to say that if there was an agreement in 2016, that's the last transaction?
So, I mean, I think we see in Davidson the last transaction was a quitclaim deed, but that the district court has discretion in determining what is the last transaction. And in this case, We have appellant admitting to a transaction that occurred in 2016, and his admission that there was a transaction involving this judgment was sufficient for the district court to make a finding that there was a transaction, and that action by the district court in determining, yes, that constitutes a transaction, is sufficient for that decision to be upheld on appeal.
But isn't it true that the 2012 judgment has completely expired? We can't renew the 2012 judgment because there are very specific provisions that have to be complied with to do that. So if the 2012 judgment has expired and it cannot be renewed, if I understand your position is that it doesn't matter because they negotiated a new deal, if you will, in 2016, and that can be reduced to a judgment, and she has 6 years from that date to reduce it to judgment. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes. Yes.
Ms. McFarland,
yes.
I thought you just said that the events that she did to try to renew the judgment don't matter because she didn't need to do it. It's essentially superfluous. And essentially all we're talking about is the alternative method of last transaction extending the judgment. So as Judge Harder said, the methods that she used to try to renew it were improper. Therefore, Mr. Landon is correct. The judge granted his motion. But then the judge went on to say Mr. Landon's attempt to say the 6 years has expired is denied because you have this last transaction. So that's what really is at issue in this case. Is this a last transaction or not?
And yes, it is. The 2016 negotiations or agreement or whatever you want to call it Charles details in his motion in the district court is sufficient to constitute a last transaction. The 2015 action in the district court by Maria to attempt to collect on this judgment also constitutes a transaction. Both of those restarted the six-year time period. So the renewal and the procedural requirements for a renewal become irrelevant because we have a new judgment and a new time period that began in 2015 and began again in 2016, so that we're now dealing with a reduced amount owed. We're dealing with a new time period that began. And that is what needs to be affirmed by this court, that the district court properly determined that the 6 months to bring an action had not expired, and that Maria can still take further action and attempt to collect on this. So we look back at Nalder that says you must do either an action or a renewal during that six-year period. Either one is sufficient, and in this case, she attempted to do the renewal, but she already had an action, and so it doesn't matter if her attempt at the renewal was ineffective.
Okay. The other problem is what do we do with her pleading then that she filed below that was untimely, that is contrary to the position you're taking on appeal? Do we just ignore that pleading that was filed below because it was untimely and the judge didn't rely upon it?
The opposition, is that what you're...
Yes, she opposed it, but the judge had already granted the request from Mr. Landon.
Clearly this appeal is based on the decision, and you can't fault a judge for something that was not considered as part of the decision that is on appeal. The arguments made in that opposition, I mean, obviously the arguments made and the factual contentions in that opposition that were not taken into account by the judge can't be a mechanism for finding a fault or reversing the district court's decision. Okay.
So his pro per status representing himself is we're going to use it against him because he didn't do it very well, and hers we're not going to use it against her because she was luckily late on submitting her pleading.
I'm not sure it's a, are we using this against someone or not? I think someone earlier asked a question of appellant, you know, you want this reversed and remanded for an evidentiary hearing so that we can, you know, the court can have a chance to determine whether or not appellant was lying in his motion. I mean, certainly it's the prerogative of the district court to make determinations as to someone's credibility. And in this situation, we have a pleading filed by appellant that clearly details a transaction that occurred in 2016. And so the that is what is on review here today.
So let me ask you this, and I'm going to ask the same question to Ms. DeFilippo in a minute and then see what she thinks. Does it matter if the 2016 contract is valid, and doesn't even matter if the 2012 decree is still valid? Because, you know, in contract law, there's a difference between the contract and the obligation. And there's a line of cases from commercial contracts that say that if you have a periodic payment, say, in your on your home mortgage, every time you make a monthly payment, you are reaffirming the obligation. It's why if you get a 30-year mortgage on your house and you pay it for 20 years and then you stop paying, it's why the bank can still sue you 20 years after the contract, even though that's way past the statute of limitations on the original contract 20 years ago. It's because for every month you paid and made payments, we reaffirm the underlying obligation. So my question to you is this: whether or not the 2016 settlement agreement was valid or not, the fact that they're even talking about it, why isn't that a reaffirmation of the obligation created by the 2012 decree, whether or not the 2012 decree is actually still valid or not?
That is exactly consistent with what we are arguing, that every single time there's an action, a transaction that reaffirms an agreement, it restarts that timing. So in this case, you have that happening in 2015 and 2016. In Davidson, you had that happening with a quitclaim deed. It's all just this restarting of the timing, as simple as the act of paying a mortgage. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. McFarland. Ms. DeFilippo, you have 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
I'm sorry, we can't hear you. I can't hear a word you're saying.
I'm sorry, Your Honors. Okay. I forgot to unmute it. I would like to first go to the obligation and reaffirming the obligation. There's a second part of NRS 11200, which would deal with existing contracts, and that whether you make payments on those and whether that changes the date of the accrual. That is different with respect to a judgment. The judgment looks at the last transaction or charge or credit, but you're looking at the evidence of indebtedness that the Davidson court said. With respect to whether you restart it or rechange it, the court in Davidson rejected those arguments and said you look at the evidence of indebtedness to determine when it accrued. It doesn't restart it. So under the respondent's analysis, anything you do, if you attempt to renew, that's the last transaction, so now we restart the date. If you attempt to do a judgment enforcing it, then that's the last transaction. If a creditor decides, hey, I'm going to give you a credit, I'm going to send a letter saying I'm going to give you a credit of $10, then that starts it. So then we're really broadening this statute of limitations as to the judgments and how they expire. And with respect to, you know, considering the opposition below or not, the court did consider the improper affidavit filing, which she gave the Charles a credit of $10,800. That is directly contrary to, with respect to what Charles said, that their agreement was whatever she got from the sale would resolve any judgment or any amount he owed. So the court did consider that affidavit of renewal, and that's in there. And that's directly contrary to what Charles said in his statement. So we need to consider that if we're not going to consider the opposition. So if the court is going to find that there was a separate agreement, then they need to send it back down to the court to make the determination. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Ms. DeFilippo. Very good work by both counsel. Ms. DeFilippo, we certainly appreciate you taking this case on a pro bono basis. Ms. McFarland's going to be in that position at 1:30 today arguing in the next case. And we really appreciate that both of you are willing to do that. You've each made excellent arguments, and we have a minimal record here, but we have the record is the record. So that's what we have to base our decision on, along with the arguments from each side. So this matter will be taken under submission with a written order as soon as we can get one out. Judge Tao, do you have any concluding comments?
Yeah, I just want to echo what Chief Judge Gibbons said. Mr. DeFilippo, thank you for taking this case. This court, on average, resolves about 1,200 cases a year, and somewhere around 30 or 40% of them are pro se cases. And some of them, and you know, and they always have problems because there are arguments that could have been raised, arguments that weren't raised, you know, that kind of thing. And so we really appreciate your willingness to jump onto this case and take it on. I don't believe family law is your normal area of practice. I didn't think so. I've had a lot of interactions with your firm. I have a lot of respect for your firm, and I was kind of surprised to see you on this, but I really appreciate that you would take this case, that your firm would let you take this case, because I know appeals always are, they're very time consuming. You have to go through the record and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And we wish there were enough attorneys in town to take all of the cases that we have on pro se, but, you know, we can't. There aren't enough attorneys willing to do that. So we really do appreciate your willingness and your firm's willingness to have you on this case. And Ms. McFarland, in advance of the next argument, same way, I'm thanking you in advance as well. It's really a pleasure when we have these pro bono cases, because it really helps us reach the right disposition on a case. And we really want to thank you.
This case is actually through the pro bono program for Maria as well. I don't know if you're aware, but that. The briefing.
Okay.
The briefing was done by two Boyd UNLV students.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yes.
Well, that's excellent. Are they able to listen into this argument? Are they in your office, or are they kind of dialed in here? Do you know?
I don't know. We sent them the link, so I'll find out after.
Well, if they're listening, then I want to thank them, you know, publicly. I wasn't aware of that, but especially to have students on this case, that's, you know, that's, they did a really good job, and we appreciate it very much.
Okay. Sorry. Thank you for clarifying that record. I forgot about that, too. Judge Bullitt, do you have any concluding comments?
Well, I will just add my thank yous to both of you, and we appreciate you participating by video conference. We know we would all like to be together in person, and that's just not available to us right now. We also appreciate you bearing with Judge Tao and I in our masks. I know that's a little bit difficult because you can't really see our facial expressions or maybe hear what we're saying. But we do appreciate it, and we thank you so much, both of you. You both did an excellent job.
Yeah, and just to pick up on there, it's one of those things where I'm sure you guys have this experience. Until this pandemic hit, you know, I never realized how much I rely on people's facial expressions to actually understand what they're saying. And now in the last 6 months, you know, I've realized I've struggled even in basic conversation, and I just never realized that. And that's something that I guess we're all learning in this unusual time.
But thank you.
All right. Hopefully our next argument, we have one argument in November, then we're scheduling some in January. Maybe by January things will be a little different. All right. We'll be in recess till 1:30.